Hope you all had a wonderful morning and are ready to dig into the scriptures this morning. The elders have asked that I cover the text of Genesis chapters 1 and 2 because it's my understanding that you all are about to have a bit of a survey start up again of the entire Bible. And so you'll want to have those two chapters open in your Bible right now. Quick question, I thought this was the case, but just to clarify, you guys haven't started the study yet. There's been no introduction to the text. No one's had a class ahead of me. Is that right? There's been no talk about it?
We have had an introduction.
Okay, you have. All right. Another fact of my Bible classes, if you've got a question, raise your hand. I love to interact in the class. It's not me lecturing. It's us talking about the scriptures together. And also, if you want me to repeat something, tell me you didn't hear that. That's just fine. I apologize right now if I can't get your name right. I know my name, and I'm pretty good with that. That's a good standard. Beyond that, everything else is gravy. And so please work with me on that. But I really love it if you participate. The text of Genesis is amazing. It is the beginning of all things. There's a way to think about it is to think about it's a series of beginnings. It's not just one beginning. Because a lot of fundamental knowledge that we have about God comes out of this book. And there's a great way to look at this passage, this section of the scriptures, and remember it this way. You learn about God in Genesis, and then you learn about Jesus in John. Those two books together tell you a whole lot about two of the most visible parts of the Godhead. Every major attribute of the character of Jehovah is seen in Genesis. Some of them are seen right from the get-go. In the beginning, God, His presence, His place, His omniscience, His all-powerful insight, His ability to craft and create. Verse 1, chapter 1, it all unfolds for you there. But even more than that, some aspects about God that are going to be revealed to us through that text are also found in Genesis. And we'll back up for a second and think about it this way. Some folks who are really unfamiliar with God and the Bible altogether have interesting roadblocks into seeing God well. That God is some distant person, or he matches a picture or a character that they've seen in a movie somewhere, and so that's what they think about God. But in Genesis, we see God's great mercy. In Genesis, we see God's compassion when He relents. We see attributes of His care, His love, His genuine concern for His creation all come up in this big, long series of beginnings. The beginning of mankind, the beginning of the universe, the beginning of the patriarchal families, the beginning of, and this is really the most important one perhaps for us, the beginning of our redemption. God's plan for our redemption stems actually before the text. Remember this key point. If you're going to make a note in your Bible, if you're going to make notes on your iPad, Revelation refers to Jesus in this term, the Lamb slain before the foundation of the world. So before Christ Himself was involved in upholding and creating the worlds by the very word of His power, God knew that His Lamb would be slain. Before He pulled the rib from Adam to fashion a suitable helpmeet, He knew His Son's duty would come into play. And so the beginning of our redemption actually starts even before Genesis 1:1, in the way in which God has related to us that picture. So a couple other things take place structurally in the text that are important before we maybe begin to dig into the immediate scriptures. Genesis is covering a really big chunk of history. Now, you're talking not just a couple of weeks, not just a segment of a person's life. I'm a book reader. I love books. How many of you have read a biography, an autobiography, either a short one or a long one? If you've been to a school, they've made you read somebody's biography and you suffered through those pages, didn't you? Sometimes we think about Genesis as some sort of history book, right? Because it's a history. Oh, it's a history book, isn't it? But it's not exactly that. Because it's a teaching book. It doesn't cover history like we would. Because every history class I've ever been to has something important that they slap up on the wall. They threw that timeline there. And they tell you that this happened in 1776, and this happened in 1850, and this happened. Genesis doesn't do that at all. It's more like reading the genealogy in the back or front of an old Bible. So-and-so begat so-and-so. So-and-so begat so-and-so. That's the structure of the Old Testament method of storytelling through history. That it's all about a family. And this is about Genesis also, the beginning of the family of God. So when we were beginning to look through these first couple chapters, keep that big thing of it's a family in your head. And keep that in there and go, okay, this is God's family. And it's God's story. And it tells me about the father of all. Not just the patriarchs, as great as they are in the narrative of each of these bits and pieces, but God, who is the father of all, the sustainer of all, the redeemer of all, the one who has great compassion for all. From the very first moment you open your mouth to speak aloud those first verses, you're actually talking about the story of you and I. Because we ourselves, whether we reject God's message and want no part of it, or whether we accept his offer of redemption, are also part of the same story. Because if we have the ability to open up that first couple pages of an old Bible, you could trace our lineage from these families to us. And you would see all of our brokenness just like you would see theirs. And so there's some great things that come up in the beginnings of the text. Who wants to read a little bit for us this morning? Who wants to serve in that capacity? I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but if you don't raise your hand, I will make you read. And so you just kind of have to pick which person you want to be, a volunteer or a voluntold. Because you're going to be one or the other. Andy, let me start, and we'll kind of move down the row. And then Lee, you can fall for less. Like I said, just bear with me. If I get a name close to being right, you're smiling. No, that's my name for right now.
You did good. You got the L anyway.
That's a success point. Hey, that's actually a good thing for me some mornings. Would you read for us the first five verses of Genesis, and would you get ready to read the next three for us? We're going to read those in a second. So verses 1 through 5 right now.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day.
You got that? A method of storytelling that Moses, by inspiration, uses to help us kind of get right into the picture of what God's doing. And there's some facts here, God's work. There's some standards being laid out. We learn about night and day. We learn about the method by which God will then encapsulate time for us. God stands apart from time. I've sometimes tried to understand it in this way, that he's seen the movie from the beginning to the end. And we, you know, he already knows who done it. He already knows all of those things. And yet, he still approaches it in his conversation with you and I who are on the screen as a fresh moment. But here we have the beginning of the things. And in this story section, if you will, God himself, we don't get to learn where he's at. A kid once asked the question, so where did God stand when he made the universe? Because a kid's perspective is different than yours and I's. But they see some things very literally. Like, well, where's he at? Well, it doesn't tell us that, does it? It doesn't give him a physical place to be. Part of that is because God is not shown to us in a physical sense. For a long time, you see that conversation take place in his interaction through his son. Because his son said what about the Father? If you have seen me, you've seen the Father. And so when you see Jesus, that's what he's like. And he says, this is what it's like. But back here, God is more seen in the other aspect of his nature, which is also mentioned, by the way, in John, that God is spirit. And so in this sense, it's a whole different way of seeing things. And Moses, by inspiration, doesn't even go into it. It doesn't even begin to get the hem of the garment treatment here, because it's not really what this is. It's not a history of where did God come from. It says from the beginnings, God created the heavens and the earth. And then it details a bit of the process. Have you ever pondered a moment what that event all kind of unfurling looks like when you read it? I'm a very pictorial person. And so you can tell me a story in words, and I will paint the picture in my head. I'm not Van Gogh, by the way, so my picture looks like stick figures. But I like to see it. And so when the scriptures say, okay, he created the heavens and the earth, and it's formless and void. All right, so I'm picturing the little blob of bubble thing going in my head. Now, what does that then imply? Well, it's unfinished. Formless means it doesn't have its form yet. Void means it's lacking. It's incomplete. That's what the terms actually then apply. So he's got this blob pictured for us, and God's not yet done. That's really kind of what it looks like there. And he gives us some more key indicators, some facts and details. And let there be light. And there's light. Now you begin to learn about God's power in that text. Because is that how it works for you and I? Let there be light, and boom, stuff just happens. It feels that way. Our culture wants it to be that pace where let's just have stuff happen. But light doesn't work that way, and life doesn't work that way. There's effort and toil and sorrow before success. And so the formlessness nature is then interceded with the light nature of God. And he said, let there be light. And it was so. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. There's a moral implication to it. Because he's going to make some statements about goodness. We sometimes accommodatively use that thing of good and bad, or good and evil. But God, in these contexts and the terminology that's using, he's not talking about this is the best light ever made. Although arguably you could say it probably was, right? But he's not making it a comparative, because what other light is there to compare to? But there is something to compare it to. Because what's the only other option on the table when there's no light, when there's light?
Darkness.
Darkness. And so by comparison to that standard, it's good. But even more so, the term that God uses is an absolute sense of good. So light then becomes a representation not only of what it is, but it tells us a truth about things. That light is good. And then remember this, how often did Jesus use the idea of dark and light in his teaching about God and man and redemption and rescue and the resurrection and our sanctification? It's like his big teaching tool. Because if I start the sentence, it's like a city set on a hill. Do you know what I'm talking about? What's that city supposed to be? It's a big light. It's a huge lantern. Okay, and do you put a lantern on the mantle of your fireplace and expect it to cast light when you put the peck measure over the lid? No, you pop it open so you can see. So light, then, is a constant teaching tool of God. And here he says in the beginning, it's good. And he's going to say that it's good a lot. He's going to say that it's good about a lot of the aspects of God's creation. why don't you go ahead and read for us verses 6, 7, and 8. I know we're kind of scattering through, but when you ask me to cover the first two chapters in one class, I could spend the whole class here in the first 8 verses and I'd be satisfied with studying it, but I'm going to try to keep my pace going. So why don't you read a little bit forward for us?
And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, the second day.
Now, it's an interesting way that this section of the text lays out, because when we talk about that expanse and all these details and waters above and waters below, we have a very jaded perspective, because we see things through the monocle of where we are right now. And we're way moved forward in history. Has the earth changed since creation? Well, it certainly has. It's aged. It's older. Have you changed since your creation?
Yes.
You have. And, if you're walking with a cane, that's an indication. If you went to the doctor and they said you've got to have an implant in to be successful to work your heart, you've changed. Well, the creation has changed too. Some of that creation is God-designed. where God influenced the creation and made modifications to how things were going, like in the flood. He said, okay, all the chasms of the deep, your water, I need you, come up. And all the fountains above, I need you. And that changed a lot of stuff. If you want to see how that change works, get your hose, go out on a dry day and make your own canyons. You can watch catastrophism take place and you can make your own little grand canyon in your backyard if you're bored enough. So that creation has changed from whatever it is here to whatever it is for now, for us. But we struggle. We struggle to understand what it was like then because, A, I wasn't there. So any impression I have about what this looks like is kind of a, again, that Van Gogh moment where I draw a picture in my head and I think that's the case. But God here is also telling us a little bit more about the aspects of the universe beyond the earth. Because he's going to talk about terminology using as the heavens. He's going to talk about a greater and lesser light as they're described for us, which we have different terms for. What, by the way, are the terms for the greater and lesser light?
Sun and the moon.
Yeah. Do we now have a better understanding of how they actually are the greater and lesser light? How many of you guys watched 5 different videos in regards to the eclipse recently to figure out what all that meant and how that all worked? And then that wasn't satisfactory and you got your fingers out and tried to... So I need a third hand to get the earth in play to figure out how that all works. Well, now we understand how God's system he built creates our understanding of the greater and lesser light. But here he just says, I'm going to do this stuff. I'm going to throw it all out there. In essence, I'm building these things. And Moses is recording what took place, because he's speaking from another person who's removed from the event as well as he writes these things down. He's not first person either. But there's some other things that take place. We now have a further extension of the idea of the calendar in this text. We've gone from morning and night. We've got the concept of day being established and what constitutes a day. Now we have a second day being recorded in the same section. So that's clarified for us. So the idea of what we refer to as a week is going to come into play too. We're even going to find out about the Sabbath, in essence, before there's a Sabbath. Because when does the idea of a religious Sabbath take place? Yeah.
Moses.
Yeah, under the law, under Moses' role as a covenant deliverer, the idea of a Sabbath gets codified, law established, if you will. But here's the foundation for some of the why. That's a factor here is coming in some of this where you see this 6+1 model take place in the creation. Tim, you're over on this side, and so we're going to jump over, and I know your name because I'm staying with you all, so that's another chunk on your table. But would you read verses 9 through 13?
Then God said, let the water under the sky be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and he called the gathering of the water seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants, and fruit trees on the earth, bearing fruit with seeds in it according to their kinds. And it was so. The earth produced vegetation, seed-bearing plants according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Evening came, and then morning, the third day.
So now you have, again, that repetition that it was good. Called it good. By the way, if you're another note-taker in your Bible and you're interested, that's a great thing to highlight. Because a lot of times in life and study of the Scriptures, we struggle to find things that are good. Well, this is like a total telltale thing. God's telling us it's good. The creation is inherently good, even though at times it feels flawed, doesn't it? Because we're part of it, too, and we feel broken. And the world doesn't work right as we want it to work, and so it seems broken. And yet God calls his creation good. And there's no qualifiers. He doesn't say it's good because. It's good because of this rationale or reason. That's part of our struggle as well, to understand some of these things. So we want a reason why it's good. God doesn't even give that here. Yeah, it's good. It's good. The psalmists tell us a lot about why the creation is good, and we learn about that later in the Psalms. David in particular writes a lot about the majesty and magnificence of God's creation. And then maybe on our own personal level, we can see the reflection of that in the good that God has accomplished through his creation. in the redemption and rescue of many, in lives of faithfulness that we've seen, and his bigger plan. But again, now he's laying all these things that he calls good. Let me add you one tidbit that's here that's always important that I kind of keep note of myself. The sequence of God's creation doesn't match the way in which man often sees the world. Man often sees the world as, before we do this, we've got to do that. When my kids were younger, we'd go on trips, vacations together, and as a family, I felt like I had to have like 5,000 things. I remember we were flying somewhere with our youngest, and we're going through the airport, and I had this luggage cart taller than me stacked with everything possible. And people would ask us, "Where are you moving?" "Oh, we're not moving. We're just going on vacation." Not getting the clue, maybe, that I wasn't packing well as a dad. But we still do that. We go on vacations, and we've got to have all these things. We've got to have this before we can do that. God's creation isn't created in that order. And here's the illustration of it. On the West Coast, there's a species of sequoia tree that's massive. The giant sequoias. Largest, living being, if you will, upon God's creation. They're massive. You can drive cars through it. You've probably seen them. They reproduce, though, in a very unique cycle of events. In order for them to reproduce successfully, they've got to have a particular species of ground squirrel. They need a fire, followed by snow. Now, why that's necessary is that their pine cones are so massive that in order for it to successfully reproduce, the fire has to be hot enough to open up the little fawns of the pine cone for the seed to drop. Now, it needs the fire to take place. The snow is necessary because of the cushion of the fall. Because if the fall is not properly cushioned, then they won't really survive the fall. And they need the moisture from the snow as well. But then that's not enough. Because these little squirrel critters, they grab the seeds and put them in the ground. Now, do we have critters yet in the creation of God and of that type? Do we have fires being described yet? None of that's there. God's method of creation doesn't match man's method of preparation and thinking about creation, because we've got to have this before that. God's not doing that. He's not building a car. This is not an automobile. He's not assembly lining together B-51 bombers. He is engaged in creation as he creates. And so here we have an expansion of life being let out. And so a first kind of life takes place. And this is an earthy kind of living beings. And yeah, they're all alive. But they're alive in different senses and different types. And yet God calls all of those things good. And at different times we recognize the value of God's bits and pieces and parts and sections that he has accomplished that sustain us and give us insight into not only whom we are, but also what God's going to accomplish through us. We need verses 14 through 19 read, and Michael, you're there, and again, I know your name, and so that's another tick in your thing. So you read that for us, please.
Sure. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. Let them be for signs for the seasons and for the days and years. Let them be for lights in the expanse of the heaven to give the light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to cover the day, the lesser light to govern the night. He made the stars also. God placed them in the expanse of heaven to give light on the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. There was evening and there was morning, a fourth day.
So now we have some additional details about the impact of light. Light's gone from existing to having a place. Light's kind of giving a home. For a long time, among scientists, the idea of light having physical matter related to it was unknown. They didn't know how light kind of worked. Recently, because of improvements in measuring devices, they figured out that light actually is a substance. It's got mass to it and weight. It's a physical thing. It's not just a phenomena of the context around it. That's important to understand, because what God has done here is he made light. They put stars in the heavens. Some of the stars are tremendously physically far from us, right? You know, even our star, which we refer to specifically as the sun, which we understand to be the same as all the rest of the stars, but it's pretty far away. And we can't get a car ride to go out there, right? And rockets, our fastest type, takes not just weeks and days, but sometimes years to get physically closer to them. And yet, light is shown to us as existing, subsisting, and being recognized by the fourth day as being from where the star would be, where the greater light would be, and the lesser light. And we see them here. God's creation expands, if you will, the string between the two parts. The light that was made there, we didn't have to wait for it to arrive. It was there. The light we're seeing now is light that God created. It's moved along the path from the string, if you will, from the star to us. And God calls that good. You ever want to get amazed and baffled? Just ponder the universe for a while. Stars beyond measure, we can't count them. And God crafted all of them, and we get to see their glory. I love being out in the bigger expanse of the world where there's no city lights at all, and looking up and seeing as many of them as I can. And it's part of God's good, what God calls good and has made for us as well. And again, now you see that continued day-night picture unfurling. We've got verses 20 through 23. Be right there, because I don't know your name yet. You get to be the reader in the blue shirt, so.
Sure. Then God said, "Let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens." God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas. And let birds multiply on the earth." There was evening and there was morning, a fifth day.
All right, so on the fifth day, the nuts disposition of life kind of comes onto the scene and explodes everywhere. In the air, in the sea. And I remember the first time I read Genesis 1, I was 18, and I'm reading about sea monsters, and that's a weird thing. That's the first time I read my Bible, by the way. It was when I was 18 years old. And so it says, "There's sea monsters." And I go, "Sea monsters?" But then you start thinking about it. What's a whale? You ever been close to a whale before? The closest whale that's been to me has been Shamu. And he splashed me. And I was terrified. That's a big creature. And he had no real desire to mess with me. Probably he was, as a creature, upset that he was in a cage and wanted to go do whale things. Whatever those might be for him for that day. But from the human standpoint, that's a small creature in God's creation by comparison to the massive whales, which truly are monstrous. And God made those. But he also made the mosquito and the gnat and every little pesky fly thing that you and I both hate. And we don't fear them. They just annoy us. And yet, in this section of the scriptures, from the standpoint of God's creation, what do we call all of them? They're good. Do we always know why they're good? Not at all. Some of the things I'm still curious about as to what purpose they serve. Like the bombardier beetle is really cool. It's a fire-breathing insect. But it actually puts forth an oxygen as it's equivalent to fire. Part of God's creation. An amazement in all of those things. And yet God is now still yet incomplete. Because remember, we started chapter 1, verse 1, formless void. Okay, he's given it form. He's given it structure. He's brought life. He's illuminated with life. And yet, it's not really complete. There's like, he's staring at the picture, and he's like, there's something on the palette not there yet. It's a way to kind of think of the way the unfolding of telling of this event is given to us. There's something incomplete in the picture, and he's going to tell us about it, and he's going to show us some more, and it's going to happen right now, but we don't know what it is yet. In the first reading of the scriptures, because a thing that I like to remember is that you had two types of history possible for the lifetime of Abraham amongst God's people. They had the potential for an oral history, but the descendants of Noah, who would have also known much more about their lives, could have been telling the story of how things came, and likely did. And they knew what they knew. But Moses getting this insight, the first time that Genesis is read before God's people? You think people are excited to see a Star Wars movie? And they are. Even though we kind of already know how it all ends. Because everyone knows how Star Wars, in essence, is eventually going to end in some sense. First time reading Genesis, as a people who have seen the mighty works of God, and then they learn of what God also had done, part of the Red Sea, man, he made us. Because that's really what's the transition point. Red Sea's nothing in comparison to the stars and all life. Which, by the way, as a reminder, is one of the great things that Paul says about God, that he is the creator of all, when he's talking to the unbelievers, the skeptics and the Gentiles of his age. He's telling them this is, in essence, the God of creation. Verses 24 through 31, who wants to volunteer for the longer chunk before you're voluntold? Roy's going to read a book for us.
And God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures after his kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb, bearing seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree, in which is the fruit of the tree, yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat, and it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day.
All right, so if you're a highlighter, underliner, and you're underlining all the goods, you need to take your pen and go back and double underline the word before it in the last section here where he says, very good. Because something changed. Each day was good, right? But when he got to the sixth day, when he accomplished his plans for that, he said, this is very good. You ever had that moment in life where you're like, this is good, and all of a sudden, that's really good. That's very good. Something shifted, right? You know, it could be a small thing. It could be a sunrise. Or it could be a grand thing. But there's something extraordinary that causes the inspiration of God, the Spirit who moved through Moses, to say, this was different. Part of it can be quickly understood to be the completion of the work. It's very good because all the parts are there. Now, God uses that method of teaching and instruction for us a lot, that we read perfect when God wrote complete, because that's how sometimes the scriptures translate the idea for us, because it's a difficult word. That perfect and complete actually are two words that are angling towards the same thing. But when we read perfect, we think, oh yeah, that means it's the very best of its kind. There's nothing ever, you know, it's everything that's awesome. When God said all parts of it, even though the parts themselves may not necessarily be perfect. Many of the parts that make up things that God calls perfect and complete are in fact not, or less. A question to ask and think about is, God said, and Moses wrote, that he blessed man. What does that blessing mean? What does it entail? The text actually gives you an answer, by the way. You can dig it up here in the scriptures. But what does the blessing, because he blessed them, but what does that mean? What does it mean to be blessed by God? We sometimes use that phrase, you know, you don't want to block one of God's blessings. You ever had something like that said to you, or you thought that? Well, I don't want to inhibit a blessing of God coming to me, because all spiritual blessings are found in Christ. I want all of them. I'm not going to play favorites. I want them all. But in this text, what does it mean to be blessed by God?
It's something special. And he begins by giving man the dominion over all these other things that he has made.
Right.
A special role that he's given to man.
Right, there's an obligation and an opportunity key to it. We can match some other Old Testament blessings in a second to see some of that.
I was thinking God made man in his image.
That's definitely the specialness of it all. We are the only part of creation that has that close connection or affinity with God. Let us make man in our image. More than any other part of the creation, our spiritual nature is seen from day one. Because we are given rules that are different than everybody else. No other critter that God created was given the injunction that don't eat that fruit. No, but we were. Because our spiritual nature signifies us as being different. Yeah.
God blessed them with purpose.
Yeah.
He created for a reason to fulfill.
Yeah, we had a role and responsibility. You think about the blessings given to the various sons of Israel and the various descendants of Israel when they were blessed by their patriarchal fathers. We refer to them as patriarchs, the leading dads, if you will. They said, you're going to be able to multiply and be a great nation, or you're going to be wealthy. But they also had obligations. You're going to serve. You're going to lead. And so you had opportunity conjoined together with some sort of obligation. Something that you were going to do. In this case, mankind broadly and generally is given the blessing, if you will, of the opportunity of creation. But the obligation to be responsible for it. We get to subdue all of this. And it's a good thing to remember, because key this together. When man was expelled from the garden due to Adam's rebellion, what was one of the specific changes in the way that he would interact with the creation?
Work.
Nothing's going to work easy anymore. Weeds, thorns. You think about a garden left untended. If you leave your garden alone for 6 months, what do you come back? Is that the bell? No, what you're listening for? Or I can ignore that first one. I didn't hear that very well. What happens to that garden? Is it perfect? All the roses are just beautifully arrayed. What creeps in? Yes. The chaos theory comes relevant to your circumstance, and every weed from every neighbor within an 8-mile radius says, this spot looks good. And takes over. And what was once beauty and order becomes disorder and confusion. And that, all of it. And so if you want to bring it back to its former glory, you have two options. My option is a match. Qualified gardener's options is much more complicated and specific and successful. And yet, it's a replication of a change in this great blessing. Because their blessing was the opportunity to subdue all of this. Before the fall, if you will. And yet after the fall and rebellion, same blessing and obligation is there. But the standard of success became harder to understand and recognize in some ways. Because now you're fighting against the creation itself. The creation bites back, if you will. And it does. Both literally at times, but also figuratively.
And yet it was helpful that God said he put the fear of man in those animals.
Yeah. And the creation broadly interacts with mankind in very specific and unique ways. You ever heard the phrase, you are what you eat? You know how literally true that is? It's not just a sense of a great little phrase, that you literally become the bits and pieces of the things that we eat. And they are what builds our body and the way God... This is amazing to me. I could be fascinated by those things for far too long on my own. But that's part, again, of this interaction we have with creation. And so in a very short few verses, God has started the beginnings of his creation, the beginnings of aspects of the covenant that we still yet see. We see the covenant unfolding in the way in which God relates to us, in part through some of these aspects of these first few days of the measuring of time from man's perspective in the beginning. Then you have 6 days lay out, day, boom, day, boom, day, and more unfurls. God's going to, in the second chapter and the third chapter, roll things back a little bit and get some details for us. And so details come into play in chapters 2 and 3 that we don't see, but not details of everything. Because he doesn't tell us about how many different species that he made. He gave us categories. And right now, even at our vaunted level of intellect in regards to the universe and to humankind, in large sections of the globe that we inhabit, we've never been to. Both under the water and above the water. And species of critters, we keep finding them. Well, that's a new one. Didn't know that thing existed before. It's similar to this other one, but it's entirely new in other ways. And so we're still learning about that, but God doesn't give us those details. Because again, this section of beginnings is not a history book. It's not a book of history. Nor is it a science manual. That's not what the scripture is. Although you can see God's creation's details in it at times very clearly, that's not what it is either. It's not telling us how to perform surgery or understand the mechanics of the eye or any of those things. Because its goal isn't that. Again, it's unfurling to us as family. You remember when we first, before the class got big into the text, we talked about these big aspects of God. We see now God shown to us in the very first chapter as a provider, an encourager, a leader of a type, certainly in charge, if you will, because he's the tell-him-what-to-doer, for lack of a technical term. He's telling the creation what to do. He's telling you and I, as part of creation, that God is sovereign or king over us. But his goals for us are clearly being hinted at as being bigger than being a garden employee. We're not just a gardener in that sense. Because we have too much of a close connection to God himself. You might tie it together with this in the text of Galatians, where there is the reminder that being adopted and translated and brought into the kingdom of God is a connection of sonship. Not just merely acquiescence that it's okay for you to be in the house and you've been allowed to be in the front door, but you're given the chief seat. You're given an equivalency to God's Son, and you're treated, in essence, the same. Ask yourself this, though, in understanding it from creation and the proximity of God that God had to his creation then and now. When you think about your relationship to God, do you see yourself being treated royally? Or do you feel, because of the humility of our circumstances, still pretty far off from God? I know I do. I understand my sin has caused great harm to my relationship to God. And it was the Son that erased that difference. God keeps wanting to pull me closer in for the hug. But the only thing that's really stopping me from getting the hug in essence as I would need is me doing this. I'm not worthy. I'm not ready. But here's a great thing about the beginnings in Genesis. We're reminded that in the beginning, there was none of that proximity problem, that distance between man and God. And especially in chapters 2 and 3, we find them interacting early on. No big deal. There's God over there. Totally normal. No, it was like no surprise. Until they chose to rebel. That tells us a whole lot about beginnings of our own understanding of how we are in relation to God. But also our need for redemption, rescue, and care and compassion that we have to show not only to others, but think about it in the most personal sense. To be compassionate with ourselves in view of the fact that God created ourselves. And just like every part of creation, from the tiniest little critters and bugs and small little things that maybe we can't even see, to the mammoth sea monsters that would terrify us if that tail flapped us around in the water. Because I know I would freak out if the big great white tail just came and slapped me around. We find fun a little bit, but afterwards it'd be unpleasant. God built us to be suitable for the journey. We are suitable not only for the physical journey of the flesh, but suitable for the spiritual journey of the soul. And he's built us, and we see that beginning here. and the clock has killed us, so we don't get chapter 2 at all. I apologize for that. I don't know if that was a hopeful expectation, but it's not the reality. So, thanks, everyone. It's a good class and a good time together in spiritual things. I've got the ability to mute it here somewhere in this time, make sure it still works.